5 minutes, please.
Sure.
Thank you. May it please the court, on behalf of Demetrius Holmes, I'm Dorian Dalton. Our argument is that the trial court erred by denying Holmes' motion to strike Juror Green for cause, where she expressed that she believed that an innocent defendant would always testify, and further expressed that if a defendant did not testify, she would be more likely to think that he was guilty.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Certainly. A prospective juror must be able to give the accused a fair and impartial trial. Whether a prospective juror can give the accused a fair and impartial trial should not be left to inference or doubt. Any reasonable...
Don, let me interrupt if I can. I have a couple of questions. Let me see if I can do them in the right order here. Let's assume that it was error to seat this juror. Given that Mr. Holmes testified in the case, and further, given that no peremptory challenge was ever exercised against this juror, why isn't the error entirely harmless if it is error in the first place?
I would submit, if I could address the second part of your question first, that it doesn't make a difference that there's no peremptory strike. Because Holmes has the statutory right to an impartial panel and of 20 from which to make his peremptory strikes. So if this...
No, that's correct. But I think in terms of whether the error is harmless or not, it's a factor to be considered. Because apparently trial counsel didn't see a lot of harm in the juror... being there since they didn't strike her for any, you know, using a peremptory on her. So, I mean, in terms of the error part of the analysis, I agree with you, absolutely. It makes no difference whatsoever to whether or not it was error to seat her in the first place, but I'm just questioning where the damage here is.
Well, and so with respect to the panel aspect of it, I would draw the court's attention to three cases. Scott v. Commonwealth from this court in 2011, which I cited in my brief, DeHart v. Commonwealth from this court in 1995, and David v. Commonwealth from this court in 1997. Scott v. Commonwealth held that the failure to strike an impartial juror for the panel is inherently prejudicial. DeHart held that the denial of the right to a jury chosen from the statutorily prescribed panel of 20, free from exception, cannot be deemed non-prejudicial. And David v. Commonwealth held that it is prejudicial error for the trial court to fail to remove a potential juror who's not impartial from the panel. With respect to Your Honor's question about Holmes testifying, I would submit that the error then comes into play with respect to his Fifth Amendment right not to testify. Although he did testify, at that point he knew that he had a juror on his panel who had said that she would not find him not guilty unless he testified. Thus, in effect, taking away his choice not to testify and infringing upon his Fifth Amendment right not to testify. It's clear that Holmes' testimony did factor in to the jury's decision, because in order for them to have convicted him, they would have had to have disbelieved his testimony. So it can't be said that his testimony did not impact the verdict. And I would submit that with respect to him testifying, that should be analyzed under a constitutional harmless error standard, whereas with respect to the panel issue, it would probably be non-constitutional harmless error analysis.
Well, counsel, speaking about the analysis under the constitutional principle, why wouldn't it meet that burden given all the evidence that was presented?
I'm sorry?
Why would it not meet the constitutional burden given all the evidence that was presented at trial in this particular case?
Why would it be harmless error under the Constitution?
Why wouldn't it be?
I would submit that it's clearly harmless error under the Constitution. Constitutional standard, if it's it's the higher standard.
No, I understand that. I'm asking why, given all the facts and what was actually presented at trial, why it doesn't meet that burden?
Oh, because it's clear that his testimony had to have impacted the jury.
But even parsing out his testimony, there's the testimony of the victim, you've got the videotape, you've got his admission to the Hanover deputy sheriff about arriving in a stolen vehicle.
Sure, there's certainly a lot of evidence, but under the constitutional harmless error standard, the question would be not whether without the error he would still have been found guilty, but whether the guilty verdict was definitely not attributable to the error. And so I don't think it's as simple as just taking out his testimony and looking at the rest of the evidence. I think that's where we would be under the non-constitutional harmless error standard. But under the constitutional harmless error, I think you have to look at what actually happened, and could we say that him testifying had no impact on the jury's verdict of guilty? With respect to, I guess, the issue of whether or not she was impartial, her voir dire demonstrated that she had beliefs that would impair her ability to follow the law as to the issues of presumption of innocence and his right not to testify. It was clear that Juror Green believed that an innocent defendant would always testify, and thus that only guilty people do not testify. Her answers during voir dire suggested that she'd not be able to find a defendant not guilty unless he testified, even after being told by defense counsel that defendant had a constitutional right not to testify, even after being told that the law requires jurors not to consider the defendant not testifying, and even after being given...
Well, let me stop you about that, because on page 47 of the joint appendix, if I'm reading it correctly, the trial court asked the juror, if the defendant doesn't testify, in one of my instructions I will tell you, don't consider that against him. And the juror responded that she understood that. And then the appellate's trial counsel said, would you be able to not consider that? Poor choice of grammar, I guess. But the juror responded in the affirmative that she would be able to not consider, if he did not testify, that she would not consider that against him. That's a lot of knots in there. But it seems to me if you parse that all out, there's enough negatives to make a positive in there. So.
And that's correct, Your Honor. When she was taken, I guess, out of the courtroom and questioned privately, she did agree with the court when the judge told her that this is what I will instruct you on the defendant not testifying. You can't consider it. Do you understand that? She said that she understood. And when then asked, could she not hold it against the defendant, she said that she wouldn't. But the difference I would submit is
that... She went on to say she would listen carefully to what he's saying. I mean, first I'd look at the evidence or whatever, and if he did testify, I would listen to what he got to say, but I wouldn't just jump to conclusions.
Right, and I think with respect to her response to the Commonwealth attorney's question, those are only with respect to if he does testify. And I think it's somewhat clear that she's saying it's not if he testifies, it's if he doesn't testify. But with respect to her answer to the judge's question, although she agrees that she would not consider it, she's agreeing in the sense of, I understand the instructions, that's what I'll do. But she had already been advised by defense counsel about the constitutional right not to testify, that the law requires the jurors not to consider him not testifying. And then when Juror Green said, nope, I still want him to testify, and then giving reasons why an innocent person would not testify, Juror Green still said that her position hadn't changed.
Certainly the defense counsel, trial counsel, correctly stated constitutional principle.
There. Right.
However, it came from defense counsel. And I think, you know, it seems to me jurors, at least in my own experience, jurors will often take what the lawyers say with a grain of salt. And until the judge says it, it's just them being an advocate. Now, there's a lot of case law that says jurors are not expected to be legally sophisticated and so forth. And I think it's human nature in the abstract, those who are not lawyers, to expect someone to defend themselves, if you will, in a courtroom if they've done nothing wrong. That's not an unreasonable attitude in the abstract. Of course, the law doesn't compel them to do that,
sure.
To be correct to point out. And so it seems to me the question isn't whether that would be a juror's preference. The question is whether the juror could set it aside if that is the juror's preference and judge the case based on the instructions of law the court gives, which would include, of course, not holding the failure to testify against someone. It seems to me the trial court certainly concluded that the juror could do that, and I think our standard review is that there's evidence in the record to support that. That kind of would be the end of it. Now, you know, if the judge had gone the other way, and if the Commonwealth were somehow in a position to appeal that, you know, again, the judge is there, they observe the demeanor, they observe the inflection, the tone, the body language, you name it, to decide whether a juror or any witness is credible when they make a statement like that. So.
Well, I think if I could make a couple points. First, if we look at what, if we take aside, I guess, the leading questions and what people sort of suggested to her to say, what she actually says is, if you're innocent, you have something to tell. But then when she's brought, I guess, set aside for a private questioning, the judge directs her to the answer that she gave that, without saying that it's wrong, it was suggested to her that that's the answer that you gave that we have a problem with. She doesn't provide any sort of explanation for changing her mind to the extent that she could be found to have changed her mind or agreed to follow the instructions. She just says, I think, an acquiescence to the trial court's suggestion that we have a problem with your answers to that question.
Counsel, just following up on the leading question part, because that's more along the lines of the Floyd case, couldn't it be distinguished here that the questions that the judge asked were actually not leading? In fact, he says after giving her, saying, this is the instruction that I'm going to give, you know, some people can't do that. He doesn't say sort of what the judge says in Foley, which is, you know, this is what's going to happen. You can do this right. So isn't there a distinguishing factor in terms of how the court approaches the rehabilitation process with the jury?
I see what you're saying, and I certainly think that the judge certainly could have done worse than the way that he did it. However, because she was directed to that particular question, and because the judge said, this is what the law requires of you, it wasn't that the judge left it open-ended. He said, this is, some people can't do this. Yes, he did say that, but he's also like, you can't consider this, even though she had just said that she would. Do you understand? I think it's very clear to her that the correct answer was, yes, I understand. Yes, I will follow the law.
If you would like to continue, you're welcome to, or if you'd like to save the remainder for rebuttal.
If I could save the remainder for rebuttal, thank you.
May it please the court, Chris Obenchain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. The question that we have here is not whether the juror had an opinion or came to court with an opinion, because certainly all jurors do come to court with opinions. The question is whether that opinion was of such a fixed and intractable character that the juror could not be fair to Mr. Holmes. And that is not what we have in this case, I submit to the court. We have a juror who expressed willingness to listen to the evidence, willingness to keep an open mind and not jump to any conclusions, and that she understood the court's instructions and would follow them. And certainly there's a broad spectrum of opinions that jurors come into the court with, but what the court has to determine is whether or not that would impair the juror's ability to be fair and impartial in this case. And I think the context of the entire voir dire...
Counsel, let me interrupt you. It seems to me what this may come down to, in terms of assuming we get to the merits of this, is a situation where, I mean, frankly, if you look at the record, I was a bit concerned with the response of, the mum or whatever it was that the court reporter typed as on the page, as a reasoned response to the trial court's question about their impartiality. But the trial court was there and observed, as I said earlier, the demeanor, the body language, and so forth. And of course, normally we defer to trial court in situations like that. But in the abstract, it certainly does concern me that the juror, at least, is reluctantly admitting that may well be the law, but that's not the way I necessarily feel about it. Now, of course, the next step is that if that is the case, can you still set that aside, or as you put it probably better than I could, is it so? Are you so intractable in your position that nothing you say about the law is going to change that? And we don't know the answer to that question. I guess we have to infer it from the HMMMs on the page that
are
typed by the court reporter.
Not
where we're at.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is somewhat where we're at. I don't know that we can infer that it was a reluctant affirmative response. I think judging by the jury...
Well, it's an inference that wouldn't be unreasonable to draw, I guess. Clearly here the trial court went the other way. But given the equivocal nature of that response, at least in the abstract, the inference could have easily gone the other way, it seems to me.
Well, I think the juror answered the initial question about, she answered, I understand, in terms of the initial question the court asked about whether she could follow the instructions, and then she gave those two responses, those mm-hmm responses, after that. So I don't know that we can draw an inference either way from that, just on the cold record. And again, I would agree with the court that the trial court was in a superior position to see the juror, to hear the responses, see the body language, and understand where the juror was coming from, but I think even the more important response in this colloquy here is when the juror had an opportunity to kind of express her own thought process, and kind of her own, get an insight into the mind of the juror, and that was where she responded to the Commonwealth's question, you know, if he testified, would you, you know, would you listen to that? She first responds affirmatively, yeah, but then she continues and kind of expands on her thinking. And
but that's all in the context of him testifying. I think Ms. Dalton's point is simply that he's not required to testify, and we have a situation where a juror, in effect, is going to require testimony before she's going to keep an open mind. That's a problem.
Well, Your Honor, I think I would dispute the idea that the juror's testimony is only responding to whether when he testifies, because what the juror says is, I would listen carefully to what he's saying, and then she says, I mean, first, I'd look at the evidence or whatever. So she's not just talking about the defendant's testimony. She's talking about all of the evidence. I mean, first, I'd look at the evidence or whatever, and if he did testify, I would listen to what he got to say, but I wouldn't just jump to conclusions. And so I think what that expresses is consistent with the other responses to all the court's questions previously, that she would have an open mind, that she wouldn't just jump to conclusions, that she'd listen to all the evidence in the case.
But counsel, let me ask you, answer that you just read, does that really go to the issue about does he have to testify, or does that go to her issue about she'll keep an open mind and listen to all the testimony?
I think it goes to her mindset as a juror of having an open mind and listening to the testimony. Again, I think that what we're dealing with is whether the juror's opinion is of such a character that essentially the accused stands convicted already in her mind when she comes into court. And I don't think that's what we're dealing with in this case. In fact, the suggestion that her opinion that an innocent person would testify would affect this defendant was suggested by defendant's counsel. It wasn't something that came from her, from the juror. It was suggested by the question that she was asked. But after that, after, you know, and I think the rehabilitation was proper in terms of she was advised by the court of what the standard was, she indicated she understood, and then she was given an opportunity to express her own thoughts, and her own thoughts were, I wouldn't just jump to conclusions, I'd listen to all the evidence, and if he testified, I'd listen to what he had to say.
What's the Commonwealth's position about the effect of the fact that he did in fact testify in this case, and that no appropriate challenge was ever exercised? Is that fact that it's a Commonwealth of positions whether that factors into our analysis at all?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I believe it does factor into the analysis. I think in terms of whether this, even if there was error on the part of the trial court, the error had to have been harmless because the question, the objection to the juror was that she might hold it against this individual if he did not testify. When that was expressed, other jurors piped up with a contrary expression or a contrary point of view, and that was affirmed by other jurors. Then he made the decision to testify. And so clearly that juror couldn't have been influenced by his decision to testify. And I think if you look at the decision to testify itself, the claim is that it was that his Fifth Amendment right was infringed by this juror's viewpoint. But if we look at the record, it's clearly the evidence that influenced.
Well, it's certainly nothing in the record that affirmably establishes that the only reason he testified was because he felt pressured to do so by the seating of this particular juror.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And looking at the case and the way the evidence came out, we have, you know, there was no issue about his identification. He was clearly seen in possession of the stolen car. He had told the officer that he had come to court in the stolen car. And so the only defense he had was to present some reason for him to be in possession of the vehicle. The fact that his testimony was not only unsuccessful, but that he was actually caught in a lie about where the person had to go to work the next day, that doesn't make the error, you know, a constitutional error. The fact that the jury didn't believe his testimony doesn't make this error. And the fact that he made the decision to testify, and certainly we can consider the fact that obviously the trial or the defense counsel didn't see this juror as needing to be struck from the veneer, and the fact that the juror ended up on the panel, while it's not, you know, obviously it's not determinative, but it is a factor that can be considered in that analysis. And I think when we get to that harmless error analysis, we have that the only factor that could have been considered here in terms of the juror weighing his testimony against him was the suggestion that the juror would have held it against him if he hadn't testified, and his decision to testify eliminated that possibility. So that is certainly something to consider. And I think the juror provided an adequate explanation and was adequately rehabilitated by the court. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you. Ms. Dahl.
To further respond to one of Judge Humphrey's questions, although the trial court is in the position to observe her demeanor, it also appears in the record that the trial court misinterpreted Juror Green's initial responses. On page 47 of the joint appendix, when defense counsel makes her first initial motion to strike Juror Green for cause, the court says, "Ms. Green." Defense counsel says that she's the one who thought an innocent person would definitely testify and didn't seem to be backing down on that position. The court says, "I read it the other way, to be honest with you." And that's, I think, not only clear that the court misinterpreted Juror Green's initial responses, but particularly because defense counsel reminded him of what Juror Green had said, and the trial court was like, that's not what I remember her saying. Also, if I can make the point that, yes, the trial court said, this is the law that I need you to follow, basically, about not considering the defendant's exercising his right not to testify. Defense counsel had already advised her of that and then asked her, basically, do you still feel that way? And Juror Green indicated, yes, I still feel that way. Even being told he has a constitutional right not to testify, the law requires you not to consider that. Also, I would suggest that there are two points in the record that suggest that the reason that Mr. Holmes did testify is because of Juror Green present. On page 22 of the joint appendix, the court, before, I guess, beginning voir dire, asks counsel to introduce their possible witnesses to the court. Defense counsel doesn't say the defendant's going to testify or defendant may testify. She says the only witness that we would have is Curtis Mullins. And then the second point that I would suggest most strongly indicates that the defendant planned not to testify is the fact that defense counsel is asking the jurors about the defendant not testifying, which suggests that she needs to make sure that this jury is okay with him not testifying because he intends not to testify. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and read counsel.